Well, for longtime listeners of NPR, you've no doubt heard the investigative reports by Salt Lake City correspondent Howard Berkus. Berkus became one of NPR's first national reporters back in 1981. Since then, he has reported on the Olympics, public lands, the Challenger explosion, and the culture of rural America. Berkus moved to NPR's investigations unit in 2010 and earlier this month reported on the failure of mine safety regulators to monitor silica dust, which has proven to be even more deadly than coal dust. His long career, though, now coming to an end. He officially retires from NPR on Monday. He joins me now in the studio, and so great to see you. Thanks for being here, Howard.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me. I actually got extended a month because we're still working on this last project. We've got a PBS Frontline documentary coming up on January 22nd, and we're still working on that. So I've got one more month to go.
Okay. And I mean, how great, though, to leave on a really high note. I mean, you've got to feel pretty good about that work.
This is a tough story that we did about what is essentially the worst clusters, biggest clusters of advanced black lung disease ever documented, which we first discovered in 2016. And in this latest project, what we did is we looked at why this is happening. So it's good to have that project done, but this is a tough story. We interviewed for this story 34 coal miners who have progressive massive fibrosis, the advanced stage of black lung, and they're all dying from the disease, and they're all going to die horrible deaths. It's good to bring this to light, but it's a tough story to work on.
Yeah. So how did this story rise to the top for you? I mean, you've been reporting on mine issues for years now.
We had reported in 2012 the resurgence of black lung disease generally, and I continued to follow that. And in 2016, I got a text message basically that clued me into the fact that black lung legal and medical clinics across Appalachia were just slammed with new cases of miners coming in with this advanced stage of black lung disease, more than any of these people at these clinics had ever seen before. And we looked into that. We reported that in 2016, and I was still interested in why this was happening. There's a regulatory system that's supposed to protect miners from coal mine dust, including silica dust that is causing this particular extreme strain of black lung disease. And so I just thought, well, there must have been something wrong in that system for these miners to be sick the way they are. We're also seeing miners who are getting sicker younger and the disease getting worse more quickly. And so there had to be something wrong in the regulatory system, and that's what I wanted to explore.
So, I mean, the story could go on because we haven't even really addressed the liability of this yet.
Well, there is a system that is supposed to pay benefits to miners with black lung disease. And just coincidentally, this week, there's a coal mine tax that coal mining companies pay for federal benefits for coal miners, and that tax is due to a 55% cut at the end of this year. That was congressionally mandated. There's been lots of demand to not go through with that cut. The fund is already $4 billion in debt, and now you have a situation in which there are younger miners getting sicker. They're getting sicker more quickly. They're going to need more benefits. Lung transplants, which some miners will get, cost $1 million apiece. So the demand on the fund is likely only to grow at a time when the tax that funds it is going to be cut. And that's happening. It doesn't look like Congress is going to act before that happens.
So what you learned is that we know about black lung, but what we found is that this is much worse, and it's not coming, the dust isn't coming from the coal as it is from the quartz that they're digging, drilling?
Yeah, what has happened, particularly in central Appalachia, is that the big coal seams were mined out over the last 30 years. And what's left are seams of coal that are much thinner. They're still valuable to coal mining companies, but they're thinner. Though the mining machines aren't smaller, the cutting tools on the mining machine are still, massive. So miners end up taking a lot of rock with coal. That rock contains quartz. That quartz, when it's cut up, creates silica dust. And the silica dust particles, because they've been cut by these mining machines, are especially fine and they're sharp. They're easily inhaled into the lungs, and they stay in the lungs forever when they're inhaled. Unlike coal dust, if you have enough rest between shifts, you can expel coal dust from your lungs, but you can't expel silica dust. And silica is 20 times more toxic than coal dust. So this dust coming into the mine environment, being inhaled by miners, is what is believed to be the cause of this advanced disease that has been striking now in record numbers.
Yeah. So how could it have been prevented?
Well, you know, what we found, there are two things that we found. One is that we looked at the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration's own data on coal dust exposure in coal mines and coal mine dust exposure, which includes measurements of exposure to silica dust. So when you look at that data, and this is the agency's own data, you can clearly see that there were 21,000 instances of exposure to excessive quantities of silica dust, quantities considered dangerous, in the last 30 years. Even after the Mine Safety Agency applied its regulatory formula to then lower the exposure after there was too much, you know, that they measured in mines, they would take a regulatory action that was supposed to protect miners afterwards. Even after they took their regulatory action, there were still 9,000 instances of excessive exposure to silica, which shows that their regulatory system just didn't work a significant amount of the time. And plus, in the 1990s, we found internal agency memos that showed there was recognition of high rates of disease, severe disease among coal miners in West Virginia, that silica was the cause. There were warnings sent out to the mining industry, but the agency never responded with a regulatory action that directly addressed the silica exposure.
So what have you learned along the way in the last 40-some years about approaching people to do a difficult story like this? I mean, you've got 34 miners that obviously willing to talk because it's their lives, but trying to get to the regulators, that's a different story there.
Well, it isn't easy to get the miners to talk, and these miners spoke to us in part because we arranged these interviews through people that they trusted. It's very difficult to get coal miners in Appalachia to talk to you if you're a reporter parachuting in from outside the region, because those people have experienced other reporters coming in and doing stories about them that merely, you know, repeat stereotypes of coal miners in Appalachia. So that's a tough thing. You have to be persistent and you have to show you're serious. The regulators, the current Mine Safety and Health Administration wouldn't talk to us. So we had to, you know, find opportunities when the head of the agency, David Zeteslo, happened to be making a rare public appearance in West Virginia. We went, we listened to him talk, and we went up to him afterwards. We did the same thing with another top agency official at a conference in West Virginia, but the agency wouldn't talk to us. So, you know, we used public records. We used the agency's own data, and we found documents that pointed to the fact that since the Clinton administration, this threat has been well known. It's not only in the agency's data, but it's in their documents. They knew what was going on, and they knew that silica was the problem, and their regulatory process does not directly address the exposure to silica. That was also known and recognized. There were attempts to change that in the Clinton administration, but there was opposition from the mining industry to that and other proposals to deal with coal mine dust. And nothing in the Obama administration, there was major reform of the coal dust rules, but they didn't address silica in particular. So, you know, the situation that existed 25 years ago exists today in terms of exposure to silica.
In this day and age of instant news, you know, with computers at our fingertips, talk to me a little bit, if you would, about how NPR agreed to go along with you. I mean, you've produced, this 22-minute segment. I mean, it sounds like it's taken months to do that. And then, you know, with not just you, but a lot of other resources.
Well, I've worked on this particular story for over a year. I did work on some other things during that time, and we did do some incremental stories. And then I've worked with a data expert, you know, at NPR. I've worked with Ohio Valley Resource, which is a regional consortium of public radio stations in Appalachia. They helped out with doing some of the interviews, and I've worked with one of their reporters a lot and one of their editors. PBS Frontline has been involved in this story. What NPR likes are stories. You know, my job description as an investigative reporter at NPR is do stories that no one has ever done, do stories that that you can demonstrate something with through data or documents or otherwise, and do stories that might have, you know, potential for impact. So I had a lot of freedom at NPR with this and all my other investigative projects because they met those particular, you know, criteria. And with this story, this is really about regulatory failure. And it involves a group of people, coal miners in Appalachia, who don't have a voice. So it was an important story to do. There was no question about that at NPR. And no resistance along the way to spending the enormous amount of time and resources that we've spent on it.
Well, as you went through, I mean, 34 interviews, all of this audio, what were you listening for to tell this story?
And by the way, I think the whole project involved more than 60 interviews, on the record, off the record, recorded. You know, what rises to the surface for me, and you can hear it in the story that we did last week on All Things Considered, and stories to come that we'll have on the radio and on PBS Frontline, are the voices of the miners, and the miners talking about what this disease has done to their lives, how it has destroyed their lives, how they can't do the simplest things anymore, what they all know what they're facing in terms of, you know, a horrific death, what one expert refers to as suffocating while alive. And also the experiences that they had mining coal. They talk about how they cut more rock and they were exposed to more silica dust while they were working, what the mining companies did or didn't do to protect them, how the dust masks they wore, which are not required, by the way, but some wore dust masks, how those failed and didn't protect them. You can't listen to what the miners tell you and sort of turn away from this situation.
Another story that you worked on, the 1986 launch of the space shuttle Challenger that ended so badly. At that time, you had spoke confidentially to a couple of Morton Thiokol engineers about their concerns that launch should have been postponed because of the temperature. No reporter likes to cite anonymous sources. So why did you in that case?
Yeah, so, you know, more than 30 years ago, we had these two Morton Thiokol engineers. I spoke with one of them in Brigham City, and my colleague Danny Zwerdling spoke with another in Huntsville, Alabama. And we separately interviewed these engineers, and they both told us exactly the same stories about what happened the night before Challenger was launched, about how the Thiokol engineers tried to stop the launch, how they were overruled by their own managers and overruled by NASA, right down to exact quotes, to exact minutes and hours of which things happened. So we had a discussion back then. Do we go with this story? They're not on the record. We can't, you know, we don't have tape of them. They wouldn't be recorded. They wouldn't be named. Do we go with this story? Should we get more sources? And in fact, I was sent out again that evening to try to get more engineers to talk to us, none of whom would. So what we decided was, because these two people were intensely involved in that discussion, they were key to that discussion, we did have another anonymous source who was not a part of this story, but who helped confirm some of what they told us. But because everything they told us was exactly the same and they were, you know, 1,000 miles apart, we decided that this was solid enough to go with.
And then on the 30th anniversary of that explosion, one of those engineers agreed to go public. Was it at your request, or did he come forward and say, I've got to get this off my chest?
No, Bob Ebling, who I had kept in touch with on and off during the 30 years, I just called him on a hunch on the 30th anniversary and said, are you ready to talk? I've asked him that over the years, and he hasn't been, of course. And he said, yeah, and I was shocked. And he told this amazing story about how he still felt guilt. And I put that story on the radio, and listeners, hundreds of listeners responded saying that's not his burden to bear. And we went back to him, and ultimately, with a follow-up story involving NASA and others, he was finally able to let that go, that guilt go that he had held on to for 30 years, and he died 3 weeks later.
Yeah. So now what for you? I mean, you got this this frontline story to follow up, but then, I mean, just going to enjoy some time off, or are you going to go teach or consult? Or?
Well, I haven't had much time to think about retirement because I've been so busy with this project. I intend to ski during the week when it's not crowded, and go into the canyons during the week when it's not crowded. I've missed a lot of trips that my wife has set up for going into the canyons, kayaking and hiking. And so there's a lot of just, you know, doing things I haven't been able to do because I work too much. And we'll see about anything else.
Yeah. So again, the January 22nd, that'll be on
PBS Frontline.
And are you narrating that? I mean, is it your story?
The current version is I'm the narrator. I'm a main character in the story. It's about how the story unfolded. But you're going to hear from some coal miners. It's really gripping video. The filmmaker is Elaine McMillian Sheldon, who was an Academy Award nominee for the film Heroine. And she's an amazing filmmaker. I encourage everyone to watch it. Even if you've heard the 22-minute story on All Things Considered, this video version will be a different experience, and you'll get to see these miners. So you know, we're still working on it, but it's a very powerful film.
Well, thank you for all your good work over the last
30
years.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Great to see you. Howard Berkus again, NPR correspondent out of Salt Lake City. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.